It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Today we ask the question, how much control we actually have over what we eat? Our guest is Professor Brian Wansink. Now, he's director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab. His book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Food writer Francine Maroukian breaks down how to think out your own cookbook library. A master chef with a puckish streak takes us where no home cook has gone before. His colleagues call Michel Richard genius, iconoclast, and provocateur. Then I take on a new challenger in our refrigerator game, Stump the Cook. Cooks Illustrated's Christopher Kimball reigns as our guest stump master. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, of all of our favorite styles of restaurant, one of the best and one of the most endangered is the urban chili parlor, the blue-collar restaurant where you can go and eat a bowl of chili and have a beer or a Coke or whatever you want on the side and basically pay about $5 for a hearty meal in the company of other chili eaters. And we found a great one in Seattle, Washington.
It's called Mike's Chili Parlor, and it is the home of the big-ass bowl of chili.
I beg your pardon.
Jane is quoting the menu here.
Okay.
It's a very, I don't want to say funky, but it's kind of a blue-collar working man's, a little bit scary until you go in and get your big-ass bowl of chili.
But then not scary at all. It's very friendly.
It's got a billiards table, video games, a lot of beer signs, and a lot of manly men sitting at the counter and the tables.
They're from Central Casting, Jane.
They are exactly from Central Casting. But I was treated like the lady I am, and I was given my own bowl of chili, which I ate very quickly.
And we should say here right away that the chili itself is not, you know, kind of gourmet, you know, celebrity chef chili. This is old-fashioned, coarse-ground beef chili with enough grease on top so that when it's served, you spoon into it, your spoon will slide through that kind of glistening layer of grease on the top.
And it gets coated,
This is Michael's very poetical way of saying it's a very greasy chili.
Well, it is, and it should be. You wouldn't want it any other way. One of the things it's always served with is a pile of oyster crackers, and the point of the oyster crackers, of course, is to go on top of the chili and help absorb some of that grease when you spoon it up. And I should say also, just with a nod to Texas, I mean, this is not Texan chili by any means, but when you order simply chili, that's all you get. Beans are optional, as are grated cheese and chopped onions. Most people, of course, get the full deal with the cheese, beans, and onions.
You know, you're right, though. This is a real American tradition. I'm thinking of, isn't it Cincinnati Five Way, where you can add
Cincinnati Five Way. Very similar,
and chili, that used to be like what you got in every diner. That was what, you know, it was sort of the bowl of sustenance during the Depression.
And chili is getting harder and harder to find. And of course, in Cincinnati, there are few places that are individual chili parlors, meaning not part of the, you know, Skyline or
a big chain or something.
Steak and Shake. And one of the charming things about Mike's Chili Parlor is that not only is it a one of a kind place, but they serve freshly squeezed handmade lemonade.
Who would have thunk?
Wow.
And you mentioned the Midwest. You can get this chili served atop a bed of spaghetti noodles if you want to go that way. The classic kind of chili mac way to
And
put
since
it.
We know that you are the queen of all Italian cooking, we'll tell
I'm
you
on my way.
These are big, not al dente noodles.
Nice soft.
They're the size of the, you know, transatlantic cable, but they're wonderful.
Hey guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Larry.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we help simplify your life midweek. We send you a worknight supper recipe along with many gems of piercing wisdom. Best of all, Weeknight Kitchen's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Book author and columnist Francine Marukian looks for the take or the food or that bit of information that gives you a different slant, which is why I like to check in with her from time to time. Hey, Francine, welcome.
Good to be here, Len.
You know, I hear that you have just completed a big project.
When I moved from New York to Philadelphia, I decided that I was going to compress my cookbook library, which, you know, is a painful thing to even think about.
Oh, gosh,
for
yeah.
those of us who like to cook and collect.
Uh-huh.
And I had about, you know, about 25 years worth of catering and food writing experience to divide by 16 linear feet of bookshelf that I was going to move into Philadelphia. So I took all my cookbooks, you know, off the shelves and I piled them on the floor. I looked at those like sort of bare shelves and I was like, where will I start? Knowing that I was going to have to get rid of many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So the first step, I sort of wrote a little program for myself. The first step, this will work for anyone who's wanting to establish a good home cookbook library, to start at the heart. For me, in the beginning, there was Julia. And even though I don't often cook from Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volumes 1 or 2, I do. They are the center of my shelf. That's where I start. It might be different for other people. Some people probably start with Marcella Hazan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe more contemporary cooks are starting with Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything,
yeah.
which is a
uh-huh.
comprehensive
yep.
cookbook. Could be A Joy of Cooking. For some people, it was the Silver Palette Cookbook. But you start at the heart. Then I put similar books on either side of Julia, some of the books I mentioned. And then I decided that the next step would be to define my interests. And because I was a caterer for so long, I am very interested in books about entertaining. So my point of view would be anything that doesn't require a glue gun went on my shelf. That eliminated. You can imagine how many crazy entertaining books that eliminated.
Yes.
It left me with books that were a little bit older, but I think that stand up over time. And I encourage people to consider old cookbooks when they're building a cookbook library. I started with Lee Bailey's Country Weekends, which was one of the first entertaining and recipe books with truly modern photography.
Yeah.
And it's 20-some-odd years old. I think it came out in 83. It stands up over time. It's still so fresh and so interesting and quite beautiful.
And his food is still simple and delicious.
You know, I had the honor of being his assistant on his last 5 books. And we would just cook the food, take it out of the oven, put it on the table, and they would photograph it.
Uh-huh.
There was no artfully arranged, you know, cunningly
right,
designed
right.
plates for Lee Bailey. It just was what it was. Clean, classic American design. Fantastic books. Then I bought a copy of My Favorite Things by Dorothy Rogers. She was the wife of the composer, Richard Rogers. And it's an older book, but her ideas about how to entertain in your home with warmth and elegance, again, stand up over time. So for me, I defined my interests. So that was step number 2. Then I decided, because I write a lot about food now, that I wanted to find my reference sources.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved over to writers whose expertise is made up of more than just research. I didn't want a book by somebody who's sitting behind a desk writing about whatever. I want someone who's out there in the trenches. And you want to talk about trenches. So my first book was The Cheese Primer by Steve Jenkins.
Yeah, he's in the trenches. Yep.
Plus, he invented cheese in America. You know, he's just so incredibly knowledgeable and so cranky that it's a great book to have on your shelf because it's funny. Interesting. You know, it's like a lecture from a really cranky old guy.
Yes.
That's just the way he is. And then The New Cook's Catalog by Bert Wolf. I like it because he pulls on equipment sources from a lot of people who write about food and a lot of people who cook for a living. And I think it's a pretty, pretty solid book. And I think it will stand up over the test of time. And then Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. I mean, you can't get any better than that.
Yeah.
Again, you know, comprehensive olive oil, chocolate, coffee, salt, a really good reference book.
Now, you consider all of these to be reference books then?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they have recipes in them or not, I think the recipes are afterthoughts. These books are based on research.
So what would be the next category then?
Oh, I think once you've got your heartbeat down, you've defined your interests, you've got your research people, then you need books that inspire you. Books that are inspirational and aspirational. Books that I don't often cook out of, but I know if I do, it will make me a better person. So these are books that are a little, you know, maybe more complicated in a way. And Simply French, the Patricia Wells book about the food of Joël Robuchon.
Oh, yeah,
again,
the great
stands
French
above
chef.
The test of time. Mm-hmm. Lovely book. And in books that have come out in the last few years, you know, Jamie Oliver, I know he's a television chef, but Jamie's Dinners, you can open that book to any page and you get a sense of who he is, his energy, his enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. They just jump out of that book and they make me want to cook. And then the Balthazar cookbook from the restaurant Balthazar in New York City. I've never seen another book, another restaurant book, so evocative of place. And you really, even though you may not go to Balthazar, but you look at any page in that book and you feel that you've been there. So I think these points are how anyone can start a cookbook library. It worked for me. I had to get rid of 400 books, but I kept what matters.
Hey, Francine, thank you.
And thank you, Lynn.
Francine Baroukian is columnist for Esquire magazine and author of Chef's Secrets, Insider Techniques from Today's Culinary Masters. As you mull what your cookbook library is going to be about, you should look at the books published by EC La Presse. They're publishing books that the large American publishers have ignored or have let go out of print. They mainly come from France and Australia. Now, their French emphasis is on chef's books. Check out the French chef Michel Bras' book, Essential Cuisine, and one by Alain Ducasse. It's called Spoon Food and Wine. Who can resist that? Another side of building a cookbook library is not necessarily the cookbook, but instead the history book. And when it comes to history, you want the latest research from the most dependable sources. Now, these sources aren't necessarily going to be on the bestseller list. So go to university presses. They're not infallible, but usually you're going to find solid writers, and you're going to find subjects and points of view that aren't the same old, same old. Well, okay, for information on some of the culinary history books we like and on EC La Presse, you can go to the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the clues to subliminal eating messages and the master chef as kitchen trickster. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. Those celebrations. There was so much food, so little time. Looking back, I mean, who knew when you would see Aunt Selma's noodle kugel again? Feeling a little bit like a baby blimp? Well, welcome to mindless eating. Now, according to Professor Brian Wansink, not one of us is immune to its lures. The professor studies hidden cues that make us eat. Now, he is the director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab. His book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Professor Wansink, welcome.
Welcome. It's good to be with you. Thank you.
The book is, or I should say, it's uplifting and depressing at the same time. You talk about that we make about 200 food choices in a single day. That's pretty stunning.
What's unbelievable about this, most people only believe they make about 15, but they forget that even just for breakfast, they decided which cereal to have, whether to have half a bowl, a full bowl, whether to put sugar on it, whether to put low-fat milk or regular milk on it. They make 12 decisions before they even have the first bite in the day.
Huh. Well, there's also the difference between real hunger and you call it emotional hunger, which is a great way to describe it. Are there ways we can figure out the difference between those two?
Yeah, there's two sort of acid tests you can use, that real hunger seldom strikes within 3 hours of having eaten. So if you've eaten 1 hour ago and you're feeling hunger, that's emotional hunger. That's not real hunger. But another thing is real hunger strikes pretty much below the neck. It strikes in our stomach. Our stomach rumbles. It makes noises. Whereas with emotional hunger, it usually strikes in our mind. You know, we think we want the taste of ice cream. We want the taste of cake, but we don't feel it down in our stomach. Also, if you look at real hunger, if you have a little bit of water, if you're really hungry, it can take away that hunger for a short period of time. With emotional hunger, all the water in the world ain't going to take care of that.
Right.
You need your ice cream.
Yeah. All right. Let's go from that to the situations where we really have no control over the environment that we're in. I'm thinking of the two extremes, the fast food place where we eat out, and then eating out in a what I think of as a sit-down restaurant. It may be a sports bar. It may be a white tablecloth restaurant. Starting with fast food, I mean, what is going on in that environment that's cueing us to eat and to want to continue eating after we're full?
That's right. Well, one of the things that cues you ends up being sort of the environment itself. Now, in a lot of fast food environments, they're painted with very stimulating colors. We find that stimulating colors not only stimulate one's appetite, but what they also cause you to do is eat a lot faster. So the typical motif in most fast food restaurants is bright yellows and reds, reflective surfaces, loud noises. All these things sort of stimulate people and cause us to eat a little bit faster than we otherwise would.
That's fascinating.
The danger, of course, the danger, of course, is that we've ended up eating a lot more food before our body can signal that it's full. By that time, we've pretty much polished off all the fries and all of our hamburgers and things like this.
You mentioned the sound. It's noisy. The surfaces are hard and shiny. Does music play into it?
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. But what's interesting is that any music will lead you to eat more. So if, let's say we have...
Oh, no!
So let's say you have the fast sort of up-tempo music. What's been found with that is that it leads people to eat a lot faster, and the faster you eat, the more you tend to consume before your body signals you that it's time to stop. On the other hand, let's say we have some very slow, sort of romantic foxtrot music playing or something like that. Mm-hmm. What happens with these sort of songs is that they lead you to eat longer at a restaurant, and the longer you end up eating at a restaurant, the more you dutifully eat. You say, geez, this is a great experience, you know. I think I'll have a dessert. You know, I think I'll have another roll. Yeah, you know. Under those circumstances, anything that makes an environment relaxing leads people to eat about 20 to 25% more over the course of a meal.
Really? Yeah. What about lighting? Because I'm thinking, you know, when it's dark and cozy, I feel like I'm nourishing myself when I eat in that environment. I don't know if that's my imagination or...
No, you're right on target. In fact, our studies end up showing that people in a darker environment tend to underestimate the calories in which they eat because, hey, after all, these calories, you know, the food's a little darker. It's a little more hidden. It's a little more subtle.
You did an experiment that I thought was really interesting, and it was about giving people a free glass of wine. Can you tell us about that?
Well, one of the things that we have associated with my lab is we have a restaurant that serves every week. It serves prefix meals, but the restaurant's only set up to actually study what people eat and how much they eat. And so one week, what we did is we gave them a free glass of Cabernet wine. But what we had done with this wine, it was all the exact same wine, what we had done is we'd soaked off the labels and we replaced it with a label that either said it was a Cabernet from California, you know, place known for wine.
Right.
Or we put a label that said it was from North Dakota, a place not known for wine.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to see was not whether the label ended up influencing a person's perception or taste of the wine, because we knew it did. What we wanted to see was whether that label would influence how much they liked the meal and how much they ate of the meal. And what we found is the people who drank what they believed was California wine, they liked the food more, they ate about 10 minutes longer, and they finished more of their food. The people, on the other hand, who believed they were drinking North Dakota wine didn't have quite such a magical evening. And when we asked them if they wanted to make reservations for the future, the answer was, things are really busy now. You know, we'll We'll talk to you later.
And I'll bet the other group was ready to make a reservation.
Yeah, and make them they did, yes. Yeah.
Professor, thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Brian Wansink is professor of marketing and nutritional science and heads the Cornell University Food and Brand Laboratory. His book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Sometimes I get cynical. We get so many cookbooks, but truly only a few grab your imagination. Well, consider my imagination piqued. Chef Michel Richard has been running extraordinary restaurants since the mid-80s, but his new book is no typical chef's tome. It's packed with surprises. Now, Richard is a brilliant trickster, and he's got more new cooking techniques up his sleeve than a card shark. The book is called Happy in the Kitchen. Michel Richard, welcome.
Oh, hi, bonjour. I'm so happy to be with you today.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. Michel, in your opinion, what one ingredient is the backbone of your kitchen?
Oh, potatoes. I love potatoes. I use potato for everything. Potato can make it creamy, you can make it silky, you can make it French fry. Who's going to create something better than a French fries? Last night I went to a restaurant, they gave me a French fry. When that French fry landed in my mouth, it's crispy outside. It was so delicious. And inside you have like a surprise, a creamy potato inside, a creamy, silky potato and crispy outside. It's nothing better in the world than French fries.
You know, when I opened the book, I got to a recipe called Spuddies, and I really did burst out laughing. These are tater tots.
No, they look like tater tots, but they are not. When they land in your mouth, a lot of crunch, a lot of flavor. They're very different. They're not loaded with fat. They're crunchy. They're beautiful. They're great.
Okay, but I think they're a great example of your sense of humor in this book and how you seem to work. Can you explain how a spuddy works?
I was trying to create a little potato cake, but crispy, and I found a way to create it, like making a sausage of shredded potato.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Add a little bit of starch, not a lot of starch, just a little bit, and gelatin to keep it together. But with the help of the plastic film, too, I was able to create a long, little thin sausage. I stick the whole thing in the freezer. When the gelatin set, you take them out of the freezer, you cut them, you fry them. We use clarified butter in my restaurant because I think butter is wonderful. It's good.
Not bad.
And it's beautiful. It's great.
The other thing that you use in this recipe that you see throughout the book is plastic wrap. Tell us how you use plastic wrap.
I use plastic wrap. You know, sometimes you want to make a sausage, you don't want to make a crab cake, whatever. And I come up with the idea of you lay down the plastic. In the middle, you add the sausage. And you roll it. It's like having a casing right there in your kitchen. It helps you to roll the sausage. Mm-hmm. You push with the plastic. And then when the sausage is cooked, you remove the plastic and you just saute the little sausage. It's perfect. Because I know when you look at the cookbook, they ask for a casing. Where are you going to get the casing? It's impossible to find a casing.
That's true.
But you have them right there in your drawer. You have the plastic. And I use that to wrap a fish sometimes. You roll it with it. It looks absolutely perfect. And the other thing, too, when you cook in plastic, too, it keeps the moisture inside, make everything moist and succulent, delicious.
You know, you do something with pasta. You do two different approaches to pasta that have nothing to do with actually using the noodle. And one of them, the low-carb carbonara. Yeah. I read this, and it was one of those things where you thought, why didn't I think of that?
Oh, yeah. First, this country loves onion. And one day I was looking at that onion, I was cutting the onion, and I realized when you cut an onion, they look like spaghetti.
Yeah.
I just steam my onion for a few seconds, sauteed with a little bit of cream, a little touch of butter, of course, and Parmesan cheese. Here we are. You can use tomato, you can use mushroom, you can use whatever you want. It's delicious.
Michel, thank you so much for talking with
us. You're welcome. I enjoy to be with. Can you spend some more time together? Maybe next week, I don't know. Bye, thank you.
Thank you. Michel Richard is author of Happy in the Kitchen. Now, you can get Michel's recipe for that onion pasta, low-carb onara, on the website, splendidtable.org. It's time to play Stump the Cook, the splendid table refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things in their refrigerator, please, nothing with green fuzz on it or anything that's shriveled. Then I have to come up with a dish from those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. Now, the other judge is our celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball. He's editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated magazine, and he is host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Christopher, good to have you with us.
Thank you. This is going to be a lot of anticipation for me. I hope you do well.
You don't hope
of course
I do
I
well.
Don't.
You hope I
of
fail miserably. Okay, who have we got?
We have Hannah and Sarah on the line. Are you guys there?
Yeah.
And where are you calling from?
We're going from Roseville, Minnesota.
Okay. And how old are you guys?
I'm 11 and I'm 13.
Okay, which one's 11?
Hannah.
Hannah's 11, okay.
Okay.
Now, in addition to the five ingredients, Lynn also gets three more items to put into this dish, and she also gets, which seems hardly fair, salt, pepper, water, and one kind of fat.
That's free.
Now, okay. I'm hoping the first thing on your list is SpongeBob SquarePants cereal. What do you guys got? What's
okay,
your list?
Okay, guys, lay it on us. What have you got? What's the list?
Coffee beans, pomegranate juice.
Pomegranate juice.
Yeah.
Yes,
this is working out. Yeah, three more.
Sour cream and corn.
Good going, guys.
Is this fresh corn or frozen corn?
Any sort of corn.
Oh, okay.
That's four, right?
That's four. What's the last one?
Wait, pomegranate juice.
Right.
Sour cream.
Right.
Butterscotch, coffee beans, and then the corn.
Ah, I missed the butterscotch.
That's a list to make Lynn cry. if you get out of this one, you go down. This is the Hall of Fame.
All right, you two. Hey, do you two cook a lot?
Sometimes. A little bit.
All right. Have you got eggs?
Eggs? Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
We want eggs.
This is not the omelet fallback thing, is it?
No.
Okay.
No. Milk?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
We have that.
All right. How about, have you got any chocolate?
Yes, we do have chocolate.
Yeah. You got chocolate.
All right. Okay.
All right. You know what we're going to do?
No, I don't.
We're going to make the most unusual and really tasty baked custard.
I'm just waiting for the corn part.
Well, the corn's going to be part of it because corn's sweet.
Okay.
You're going to turn your oven to about 325 degrees, and you're going to get some small containers. You know, they should hold the equivalent of maybe a coffee cup, and they should be something you can put in the oven. What you're going to do is you're going to take about five eggs, put them in a big bowl, and you're going to beat them up, and you're going to add about a cup of milk to that. You're going to add a cup of pomegranate juice to that. You're going to add... Chris, stop rolling your eyes up to the ceiling.
I'm going to leave. I'll be back in a couple minutes.
All right. So. Now, wait a minute. Okay.
All right.
You're going to add about a cup of sour cream to that. And you're going to add about a cup of butterscotch.
Oh,
and I hear them screaming.
This is, Hannah, what do you guys, Sarah, what do you think of it so far? Is it sounding good?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
All right, because this is my thought. The pomegranate juice has a tart quality to it. The sour cream is really rich. The butterscotch is the sugar, but it's also really, really rich. And then you're going to stir in a half a cup of corn because you can make sweet things with corn. So, and what you're going to do is take that all, pour it into these, you know, small containers that you're going to bake them in, like custard cups. Going to put them in a bigger pan, and then your parents are going to pour some hot water in the pan so it comes halfway up the sides of these custard cups. And you're going to bake them about 45 minutes to an hour until when you put a knife in the center of one of them, it comes out with only a teeny bit of moisture.
I think you've put a knife in the center of this recipe, but go ahead.
Keep going. A pomegranate butterscotch custard. What could be bad with a rich sour cream?
And this
in
is
there?
$22 at a fancy New York restaurant,
exactly.
Right? Yeah, now, you said there's a sauce with this.
What you're going to do is you're going to make some coffee from the coffee beans, all right? Add chocolate, melt that all together, okay? And that's going to be your sauce. Just a teaspoon.
So, Lynn, what's the name of this dessert, may I ask?
This is going to be butterscotch pomegranate custards with coffee, chocolate, dollop.
Well, guys, what do you think? Hannah? Sarah, would you eat this?
Yeah, I think it sounds pretty good. I'm not sure.
Now, we have one honest one out of the two. No, I'm sorry. You did the best you could with the ingredients, but... I mean, it was impossible.
I have to say, you guys presented one of the best challenges that we have had in a long time. And although I hate losing, I have to credit you for imagination.
Nice job, guys. Thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Anna.
Good luck in the kitchen.
And thank you, Christopher. I know you're going to gloat for the rest of the week.
Well, you did the best you could do. Wasn't good enough, but it was the best you could do.
Our celebrity guest stuntmaster is Christopher Kimball. He's editor and publisher of Cooks Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, if you want to challenge me and stump the cook, give us a call, 800-537-5252, and one of our canny producers may call you to be on the air. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what does the recently coined term food shed mean? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. Now, you can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what does the recently coined term food shed mean? Well, it means the local region that supplies your food, as in the watershed supplying an area's water. New York Times journalist Kim Severson coined the term in a recent piece that she did on the new trends in how we're shopping. Now, evidently, not only does the food have to be organic, but it has to be local. And for those who can afford to be picky, the latest concern is food miles. How many miles did that banana travel to get here? Of course, the fewer miles on your dinner plate, the better. Life is not simple. Do you buy the organic banana from Costa Rica or the non-organic apple from the next town? And for those who want to be on the very top of the ethical, sociological, and ecological heaps, you'd better make sure that the apple wasn't raised on a factory farm. It isn't easy being green. It's time for your calls. Pick up that phone, guys. The number is 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get going. We have got Saber on the line from Minneapolis. Hey, Saber, what do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good.
Well, I love your show, just like all your listeners, but I have one problem with it.
What's that?
It's addicting.
That's the nicest thing you could absolutely say to us.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, here's the story. Here's how it started.
Uh-huh.
I was cooking some noodle one day, and I decided to become a little creative.
Uh-huh.
I put some spices, and I involved, like, some blue cheese in it and all that. And I thought it was really tasty. It was beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And then I cooked it for a cousin of mine, and I had him taste it. He said, that is really good. What's in there? And then I said, well, I'm sorry. That's my secret recipe. I'm not going to tell you. And then I was listening to your show last week, and I said, you know, one day I'm going to call this show and, you know, ask if I can get a pen on a recipe, or you can sell it to a restaurant or make some money out of it.
Huh. Mm-hmm. That's a really great question.
Well, thank you.
But by the way, you wouldn't want to give us a hint of what's in the recipe, would you?
Absolutely not. You have to try harder with me.
I understand. Well, I'll tell you, generally speaking, okay, patenting a recipe. I know you can't copyright a recipe. You can copyright the form that it's in with, I think, you know, I'm not an attorney. This is really a question for an expert. But I think the way it works is you can patent a method for cooking a food. But I do know, at least from the experience of a friend of mine who wasn't trying to patent a dish, was trying to patent something else, patenting is a really expensive process. It can be like $10,000 or $20,000.
I know.
Yeah, but one way you can work it is try to sell the recipe to a food company that produces food.
Yeah, that's what I thought of.
And I'm not sure how you would approach them, but, I mean, if you look at some of the big companies, the ones who have the money is really what you want, that are always looking for something new. Study their lines. You know, what do they make? And where would your creation fit in? I mean, then you contact them and you say, you know, I've got something that I think would really, really sell. And would really complement everything and open up that line in a way that you haven't opened it up before. If you can get in the office and you can convince them, you know, that would be one way. But the patenting process is pretty involved. So I'd say check it out with an attorney first. Generally speaking, restaurants generally don't buy recipes. What they might pay for is they'll have a consultant who might develop material for them because they're an expert in that particular area. You know, for instance, I just was at a Greek restaurant in New York, and they had a very well-known, very highly regarded woman from Greece. She's a food authority, and she helped them develop the recipes with American ingredients so that it would taste like Greece. So that's kind of how the restaurant thing works.
Another thing I thought of is, like, you know, the products I use, you can use some advertising, of course, you know, which they always need.
That is brilliant, because that's saying, look, I'm using your product. Can we come to an understanding here? You can put this recipe on the box.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sometimes you see some recipes on some boxes of products.
That's right.
And stuff.
And people pay very good money for that.
Well, I guess I'm on my way there then.
Once I
have them tasted, they're going to be all over me, I guarantee you.
But you know what? Don't let them taste it until you feel there's a real interest.
Exactly.
You know, right. Because you get a really good R&D person in the room and someone, you know, who is a food scientist. And I'm very, very cynical by nature when it comes to this kind of thing. So I would be very careful in that regard. This is where talk to an attorney, because there may be a case where you can actually have them sign something like a non-disclosure agreement or something where you are protected.
Absolutely. It'll be very nice, you know, to, you know, collect royalties for that for the rest of your life.
I would love to think that someone who listened to this show cooked set them up for life. Somehow that just makes me feel really good. Hey, will you give us a call down the line and let us know how it goes?
Well, I'll send you a commission in the mail, I guarantee you. Thank you very much. And you've been really helpful. Now, keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you.
All right, have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
I'll tell you, you never know. There are people who have built fortunes on this kind of thing. Anyway, you can call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Alan on the line from Breckenridge, Colorado. Alan, hi, what do you want to talk about?
We buy artisan fresh breads up here in the mountains, which we love to eat. And unfortunately, the extremely dry climate at the elevation we live at, the breads go stale extremely fast.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering if there was some secret method that you're aware of that would help us to enjoy our breads for longer before we have to toss them out.
A secret method. I lived in that environment. I mean, I lived in Denver, not up in Breckenridge. Breckenridge is even higher up. How high are you guys?
10,000 feet.
Oh, boy, that's up there. Whoa. Where are you from, Alan?
I grew up in Ireland.
I thought maybe so, and at a much lower elevation, I think.
Yes.
It's extraordinarily dry. But I think, what about the plastic bag?
Unfortunately, the lovely, crusty exterior of the bread is lost, and it goes soft
in the
plastic bag.
This is the problem. When you're in that environment, it sucks every bit of moisture out of that bread. So it's a case of the bread practically goes stale, you know, as it comes out of the oven. I really think this is the solution here, because this is what I did when we were living there. First of all, if you can get breads that are very slowly risen, you know, with a small amount of yeast, they tend to stale a lot more slowly. That would be the artisan breads with the really tough crust, but I'm thinking that that's what you're buying right now, right?
Yes, correct. There's a French bakery that we love.
I hate to tell you, but I think the key here is the old business about you put it in the plastic bag because it'll hold just a bit more moisture. Don't refrigerate it because the refrigerator is even drier than the exterior, you know, than your home is. And then what you do is you crisp it in the oven.
Aha.
Yeah, because – and that will – you don't even have to heat it all the way through. The idea is you'll crisp the crust. And there's an old trick, too, to stale bread. I've talked about this on the air before, and people think I'm nuts. But, you know, I come from a family where no one threw bread out. And what you did is you just literally dampened your hands under the tap, and you moistened the crust with water. And then you put it – yeah. And what happened is it helped the crust crisp. And when bread was really stale, you know, stale right through, my grandmother would take that loaf and she would, again, moisten it and she would wrap it in something like foil, something that was airtight. And she would put it in the oven at about 350 degrees for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. In so many words, until it was hot all the way through, it would revive the bread. And then she'd open it up just for a few minutes to make sure the crust was crisp. Now, you have to eat that pretty quickly because if it's really stale bread, it's going to, once it cools down and sits for a little while, it's going to, you know, turn to rock.
Right.
But that's when you dig out the book and you do the bread soups and the bread salads and the bread sauces and the bread. But I think all those two methods, use the plastic bag, crisp it in the oven, and then when it goes stale, revive it at least for one go round.
My mum in Ireland used to make bread pudding out of it once it went stale.
Well, there is absolutely, there's never been anything wrong with bread pudding. And you know, you can do a savory version too. Oh, Alan, we've got all kinds of possibilities.
Thank you very, very much.
You are welcome. Thanks for calling.
Your show. Bye now.
Thank you. Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Peggy calling from St. Paul. Peggy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have an odd question.
I love odd questions.
Well, not that bad. I used to live in an apartment, and I just moved to a very small little townhouse.
Uh-huh.
And a blended family, and we're crammed in there like sardines. I have two pieces of furniture that were decorative in the apartment, and now in the townhouse, they have butcher block tops, and I want to use them for their butcher block top. My problem is sanitation. I don't have a problem cutting up vegetables on it and stuff, but meats and... How do you clean it? How do you keep it safe?
All right, two things. First of all, never, under any circumstances, put any kind of raw animal protein, anything from the drip, you know, from a raw egg to cutting meat on the same surface that you would normally cut things that you eat raw.
Okay.
So just figure, and by the way you solve that problem, what I do is I have a plastic cutting board. I have a couple of them. Yeah, and that's my meat board, and I can put it in the dishwasher and whatever. But you're saying you've never actually cut on wood, so you want to know how to clean wood. Is that the crux
of
what?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, couple of things. First of all, believe it or not, there are actually some scientists who believe that wood is more sanitary than plastic. There's a lot of debate about this. But two things you want to do with it. First of all, you want to have a bottle, a spray bottle, where you have what's called bleach water.
Okay.
It's about a teaspoon to a tablespoon of bleach for every quart of water. When you're done chopping, just wipe the board with soapy water and then with a paper towel that you've saturated with water to rinse it. Mm-hmm. And then what you do is you give it a spritz with the bleach water. You just, you know, count to 30 and then wash that off.
Okay.
Now, that's essentially gotten rid of the surface bacteria. Another thing that I do periodically with, because I have a big butcher block, you know, rolling thing in my kitchen. We call it the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my work surface. And I have plastic boards I put on it when I'm working with it, you know, with the proteins. Anyway, the point is, whenever I feel ambitious and it's a slow weekend, I sprinkle it with coarse salt and I sprinkle it generously with vinegar, cheap vinegar, obviously.
Yeah.
And I scrub that in and then I just let it sit for, I don't know, while I go and watch TV or go shopping or whatever. And then I take a pastry scraper and I scrape that all off.
Ah.
and I get
no mineral oil, huh?
No, I can mineral oil after that if I want to, but I rinse that completely because the acid and the salt is extremely inhospitable to bacteria. It tends to soak in beneath the surface of the wood over that period of time. And then by scraping with the pastry scraper, I'm taking up any gunk or whatever. And then I can just do a little bit of mineral oil. But always the bleach water right after you're done. Just keep it, because that's also the kind
of thing. I'll just keep it in the unit.
Yeah, you can do that on your, you know, on your countertops. You can do it on your doorknobs. You can do it anywhere you want because it's a disinfectant.
Well, thank you.
You are welcome. And butcher block, I personally think the more cuts there are on a butcher block top, the more gorgeous it is.
Perfect.
Pristine is not my thing.
Well, thank you very much.
And enjoy the new home and the new blended family.
Thank you.
You take care.
Yeah, bye.
Bye. Picture this. You've got a glass in your hand. You take a sip and you mull. Is what's in that glass broad and lingering or focused and short? And what about its terroir? Well, okay, you know this isn't about wine, but what it is about is bottled waters. Now, this is how Michael Masha approaches a glass of H2O. His book is Fine Waters, A Connoisseur's Guide to the World's Most Distinctive Bottled Waters. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, I know there's bubbly and I know there's still, but what are the distinctive differences in bottled waters?
I think it's really important with bottled water that you start paying attention to the water and not treat it as a commodity. And once you do that, you will notice that bottled water has many different sources. We usually are familiar with spring water, but there's also artesian water. There's water that comes from rain. You can buy now rainwater. So it's really important paying attention to the water and where it's coming from.
So are there distinctive styles of water and are there certain brands, you know, that we can taste and say, oh, that's what this type of water tastes like?
I mean, the most distinctive difference is, of course, you know, the classic still or sparkling, the only choice you have in your restaurant.
Right.
And the problem I'm having with that is sparkling is such a wide range of waters, and usually in the U.S., sparkling is associated with, you know, loud, big bubbles. You know, everyone is familiar with Perrier, the firework in your mouth type of bubbles. But, for example, there are many other waters, some of them naturally carbonated, that have much finer, softer bubbles, and that are much better to be matched with food than just using the loud bubbles.
Which ones are you thinking of?
Badoit, for example, is fairly common in the U.S. It's also natural sparkling mineral water, which has very, very soft, fine bubbles. And most people that say they don't like sparkling water, suddenly if you introduce them to Badoit, they say, oh, that's what I like. It has just a little bit of effervescence.
Oh, so that's, I see what you're saying. Now, what about in the still waters, the ones that don't have bubbles?
You know, once you leave the bubbles aside, the distinction between the waters becomes very subtle. If you compare it to wine, you know, wine smells and it has some color.
Right.
Hopefully your water doesn't smell and hopefully it doesn't have any color in
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly.
But the thing that kicks in, especially with still water, is the mineral content or minerality, as I call it. And it basically reflects how much minerals are dissolved in the water. And the connotation is TDS. You see this on every bottle. And low mineral waters have between, let's say, 5 to 50 milligrams per liter in water. And that's what most Americans like with still water. In Europe, it's very different. People prefer, they call it mineral water, and they prefer to have much, much more minerals in their water, up to 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 milligrams per liter, at which point you definitely feel the water a little bit more substantial, and you feel like you're drinking something different from a very light spring water.
Huh. Well, I have to ask you this. Do you ever drink water just from the tap?
I do, because there's nothing wrong with tap water. I think in the industry and some journalists try to portray a conflict between bottled water and tap water. I think there's nothing wrong with tap water in most instances in the U.S. You know, tap water is very safe to drink, and in some places actually very enjoyable.
Michael, thank you.
Absolutely.
Michael Masha is author of Fine Waters, A Connoisseur's Guide. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous. Water which is too pure cannot sustain fish.
The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. You'll find our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and podcasts of all stripes available for free. So be sure to check them out. That's splendidtable.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical wizard is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.